Steph Curry, active tonight, enters the game. And here's Curry, gets free and hits. Steph Curry, you are amazing.
The show that Steph Curry put on, it was absolutely, positively spectacular.
Long two is good.
This guy hasn't played a basketball game in 2 weeks.
Curry fires up a three and it goes.
Cold-blooded three.
There's Steph Curry. Curry for three, out the way, got it.
What a game.
We are witnessing greatness here.
This is dominant in overtime.
That's why he's MVP.
We're going to bring y'all into our huddle.
You are in the Warriors Huddle with me, Brandon. With me as always, my boy and producer, Scott.
Scott here.
Scott, we got big things going this week, man. Not only a two-man booth, not only a return to the Western Conference Finals for the Warriors, but at least specifically for the Huddle, a return to my house instead of the usual studio. Kind of a return to our roots, man.
This is back where it all started, and, you know, two-man booth, maybe I'll actually get to say something today.
I'm hoping not. What I really hope, actually, is that we've deeply buried that first episode, because it was some of the worst radio in the history of radio. That is gone, right? Nobody can find it?
No, I came across it the other day. I think it'll be released someday.
Oh, absolutely not. Over my dead body. I'm sure people are not tuning in now to hear us talk about our not-so-illustrious past. Let's jump into the Warriors' focus. In fact, this is hot off the presses. Obviously, we know that the Warriors beat Portland in their series. Just tonight, Oklahoma City finished off San Antonio in six. So we know who the Warriors are going to be playing starting next Monday.
I mean, how surprised are you by that?
Really surprised, honestly. And I'm not sure I wanted to see it. So going into it, who did you want to win that series? Who did you want to be the Warriors' opponent?
At the time, going in, I didn't really care because I saw advantages and disadvantages to playing either team. But as the series went on, so I guess let me backtrack. Going in, I wanted to just go seven. I wanted the teams to beat up on each other as much as possible. As the series went on, I said I'd rather play the Spurs, and I was kind of surprised to have the thoughts in my head, why was I so scared of this team?
Right. I wanted the Spurs tonight for sure because I wanted seven games with Bogut's hip injury kind of looming over the Warriors and the possibility of Draymond's ankle blowing up on him overnight. I figured the more rest they could get, the better. As far as overall, I always wanted it to be the Spurs, and I had a weird realization tonight. At first, I think it's because I've been viewing them as the end game all year, so the season would feel weird if we got to the Western Conference Finals and didn't get to knock them down. But tonight, if I'm being honest, that changed a little bit. I was rooting for the Spurs, and I think it's because I have some kind of weird nostalgic connection with them. It made me feel old watching them lose. They have been on top of the league forever. I hate change. It's one of my like strange neuroses, and that's true in sports as well as life. So to watch them get beat and basically kick the hell out of that gym, except for, you know, a late spurt there in the end, was weird for me. I wanted to see them there.
The same exact thing happened last year, though. Did you have the same thoughts? I mean, they didn't make it to the Western Conference Finals last year.
I didn't. I didn't have the same thoughts. I didn't watch it. That might be the difference. But the other thing was, I mean, combine it with what I said up front. Watching the Spurs out front all year. I mean, you, me, Rusty talked all year about how San Antonio was going to be there, how dangerous they were, how ironic it was that even though the Warriors were doing all these things, the Spurs were doing it too. So I guess it was that combination, realizing that there's a huge difference between the regular season and the postseason, and then watching San Antonio go down.
I mean, is this going to kick back up all the lucky talk that if the Warriors win it, again, they will not have played the Clippers, and they will not have played the Spurs.
What the hell are you talking about? They lost the MVP. So no, if people say that they are lucky, then they are even stupider than they were when they first said it. So no, there's not going to be any lucky talk. Also, I am so happy that they proved to not be the same old Warriors like you were trying to throw around. Now, we are really burying the lead. In fact, what I wanted to quickly do is a quick and dirty analysis of OKC versus the Warriors. We didn't get a chance to really look into it. We will. You and I will do something more in depth next week. But let's just give preliminary opinions right now. Let me start this way. What do you think the Warriors have to do to beat OKC start next week? I'll shoot off a first answer. get their mojo back. We'll talk about the Portland series. I was happy with it. They won, but the ball movement kind of came to a screaming halt. We didn't seem the same kind of crisp play that the Warriors illustrated over 73 games. I don't think it's something specific they have to do to beat OKC, but I do think they need to go back to how they were playing before they started getting a little bit lethargic after Steph's injury.
Especially the ball movement. I thought in that the last game in the Portland series, even the ball just wasn't moving in the way that it used to. It was a lot more ISO, a lot more one-on-one stuff.
It's hero ball. It's Mark Jackson stuff, right? I mean, and like maybe that's because they got out. Well, Steph goes down. The entire dynamics change. They, you know, so they needed to force offense. And then Steph comes back. It'll take him a minute to get back into the rhythm that they had established over an entire regular season. So I have every reason to believe they'll be able to do it, but they better. Otherwise, they're going to lose that series.
Yeah, well, you know what you're going to get from Durant and Westbrook. They're going to be a handful. They're going to probably win a game just on their own. But I think you're going to have to figure out how not to get beat by Steven Adams, who's been playing like the double-double machine. Yeah. And hopefully Serge Ibaka still remains kind of missing in action as he's sort of been this season.
Who's the most important Warrior in that season, or a season, in that series? Outside of Steph.
Most important Warrior?
Yeah, take Steph, put him to the side. Who's the next person? If somebody has to step up to make sure the Warriors win, who is that person against OKC?
I think it's Klay Thompson. I mean, he's carried this team so far. He is the leading the league in scoring in the NBA playoffs. Yeah. And he's going to be assigned with guarding Russell Westbrook, who I think really is the head guy in charge of that team.
I'm going to do something that will make you happy, admit that I'm wrong, and then something hopefully will piss you off, admit that you're wrong as well. Admit that I'm wrong. Klay Thompson. Before, a few times, I've said that I don't think he could be the best player on a championship team. I asked Steinmetz. I wanted him to agree with me. I asked Barnett. I wanted him to agree with me. Neither of them did. And now I'm finally realizing I'm wrong. I think Klay could, in fact, I think we have seen Klay do things that Steph has not since Steph went down. More specifically, Klay chases around the best offensive player on one side of the floor and then gets past the best defensive player on the other side of the floor when Steph's not around. So,
and he's so consistent.
Yes. And, like, and you know, unflappable, you know, and he does have that attitude. So he could be the best. Now, here's why you are wrong. I think that offense is going to be there. What I'm worried about is being able to really hold down that OKC team, and that means Draymond to me. You know we're going to see him against Durant. You know we're going to see him against Westbrook. You know we're going to see him against Ibaka. I mean, he's going to be everywhere. If these guys hope to lock them down, something they didn't do against Portland, it's going to start with Green.
And what's really troubling, if that is true, is Draymond's defense in the last two games of that Portland series. Well, let me take that back.
Yeah, whoa. Because right now I just had a bunch of images of FO tossing Portland players left and
okay,
right.
Okay, let me say the first half of Game 5 and then most
a little
of...
specific now, yeah. You mean like for one play in the third quarter of Game 2, I noticed that he was not very good at defense.
And he said it himself after Game 4 that he wasn't good on defense and that for him, he said he looks back at this season and the best game that he had was against Oklahoma City when it was away, and he had 1 point, but he said he controlled the game
right
from a defensive side of things.
Do you like what we'll get back? We'll get back to the OKC thing specifically in a minute. Did you like when he came out and said Portland's done after Game 4? They still had a game left. Do you like that he went out, went on record? Okay, of course Portland's done.
No, I hated that. I hated that because I'm a believer in the jinx, and I'm just like, dude, what are you? Why are you doing this?
You know what I like? I like the concept of putting bulletin board material on your own bulletin board, right? Like we always hear those kind of things. They end up in an opposing team's bulletin board, and it gets them all fired up, and I'm sure that's exactly what happened against Portland. But when he talked about it and when Steve Kerr talked about it, it sounded like Draymond wasn't telling that to Portland. He was telling it to the Warriors. He was adding an urgency to a game that maybe they wouldn't have been that urgent. You know?
But I think we can go back on this very podcast and see from this playoffs what you said about Jason Terry and Jason Terry coming out guaranteeing the game. Because he said the same thing afterwards. He was like, I was just trying to get my guys pumped up. Yeah. And I think he caught a lot of criticism for that. And the Warriors put it up on their bulletin board and used it as they wanted to use it.
The next time you find yourself comparing Draymond Green to Jason the Jet loser Terry, I'm going to take it really hard. Also,
I think they each have the same number of championships.
You should also notice that I am kind of one of those do as I say, not as I do guys, you know, but the variant here is I support whatever the hell my team does and generally speaking, hate whatever the other team does. So there's your constant. Turning quickly back to the OKC series, kind of a more random question, but one I'm fired up for. What candidates do you have of OKC Thunder players who we will be the most annoyed by? Whose face will we hate the most by the end of the series?
Well, I think you got to take Steven Adams out of the discussion because he's just a given, no question about it.
I mean, already hate him, right. So yeah. Okay, fair enough. We'll put him to the side.
Taking Steven Adams off the board, I'm going to go with,
take your time.
I'll do Dion Waiters.
You bastard. I mean, let the record reflect that we talked about this beforehand, and I mentioned that before. I feel like you're stealing my answer. Is that fair to say?
Only because, again, even in our conversation off record, you still barely let me get a word out. So you asked the question, and then you jumped immediately in with Dion Waiters.
I noticed you take notes. You immediately wrote on your hand, Dion Waiters. I'm saying that later. Why? Why Dion?
For one, the guy's just not very good, but he thinks he's amazing. And so he's going to have some game where he hits 3 to 4 3-pointers. He's going to be like celebrating like it's something he does on the regular, and he doesn't.
Yeah.
And he just doesn't deserve to celebrate like that.
No doubt. And he's going to have, it'll be more than 3 or 4. He'll have one really good game. He'll, you know, put up like 25, and I won't be able to stand his success. Theo Roberson, because he doesn't have a T in his name, really bothers me that it should obviously be Robertson. Ammo, maybe. Here's another obvious one. Russell Westbrook has been so ferocious with his celebrations in the past that he always tends to kind of get me angry as the game develops. So he'll be that guy.
Canner's mustache.
Oh, my God. That thing is awful. It is so thin and molestery. I mean, it looks like a porn star from like the late 70s or something. No, that is okay. Fair enough. Canner's mustache and just his general game. All right, with those people in front of us, I'm going to break the rules and go with Steven Adams. How about you? How about you?
How many? I mean, what's the over-under on like technical fouls that the Warriors get from kind of being prodded by Adams?
2.5.
Because he's the type of guy who he hits you, you hit him back, and the ref sees you. You know,
oh, yeah.
Retaliating.
When he wants to fight, he's like Bogut. I go 2.5 and take the over. How about how many times do Bogut and Steven Adams have to be separated over the course of the series? I put the over under at 4. What do you take?
I'm going over.
Yeah, me too, man. I mean, you know what? It should be a hell of a series. Like, I'm fired up for it. I like the concept. If the Warriors don't win it, I will hate every moment. But this is a hell of a matchup and one we should all be looking forward to. Let's look back now that we've looked forward. Give me your analysis of the Portland series. What did you think of the Warriors?
To rise to the occasion with Steph on the bench, I thought was something that just spoke volumes about what this team is all about. Like, they figure out a way to win and get it done and rise to the occasion. It's like the next man up philosophy that they've been talking about.
Strength in numbers. I like that. I've had a more... And I think we're just looking at two different portions of the series. I guess so. I was going to say it felt like watching the Globetrotters win by 5, which is not what anybody goes to go watch the Globetrotters do, right? We thought that they were going to stomp these guys, and they did not. Portland was in every single one of these games. I heard Clay say it was the closest 5-game series in the history of 5-game series.
No, I mean, I bet if you looked at the percentage of time that Portland had the lead versus Warriors,
right,
it's got to favor Portland.
The entire time.
That would be a weird... What if the NBA changed their rules and said, actually, we're not going to do who won each game. It's just by the end of 5 or 7 games, who has the most points?
You know, you did have my vote as future commissioner, but after that terrible suggestion, that is absolutely no longer on the table.
Because the Warriors would have lost this.
Here, let me give you another, both a good and a bad view at the Warriors. Here's good. And super random. But do you remember the somewhat cutty Looney Tunes character Pepe Le Pew?
Yeah.
Pepe Le Pew, for those of skunk. You maybe too young, yeah, was a skunk. And the entire episode, he would be chasing a cat that he mistook as a skunk. And I think the implication was he was going to, like, rape that cat. It always felt a little bit dicey to me.
Wasn't that the basic plot line of every Looney Tunes?
I don't think rape. I'm not sure if rape was the basic plot line.
I'm just saying, like, chasing around somebody else.
In this in particular chasing cartoon, what would happen is that the cat would sprint out ahead, would climb over buildings and get up trees and go over hills and would have this what seemed to be insurmountable lead on Pepe Le Pew. And he'd look back, and Pepe Le Pew just kept the exact same pace the entire time. Never tripped. never went too hard, never sped up, nothing. And you always knew the entire time that at the end of the cartoon, the Pepe Le Pew would catch up and ultimately win. Every one of those games felt like that. The Warriors were down 17 in game two, 16 in game four, and had an 11-point deficit when they closed out the series just last night. Every single one of those games, I felt confident that they were going to come back, you know, that they were going to catch the cat. The difference, the bad side, is that they're no longer chasing cats, right? This next thing, you're moving up towards a lion. If they continue to bring this kind of B-minus game, you know,
these slow starts.
Yeah, all of it. You know, I mean, like the confidence that they showed and the ability to kind of catch up was phenomenal, and I love to see it. And they've earned that right. They got to play two teams that they could beat with their B-minus game. But that time is over now. And if the lack of ball movement continues, if the pace is no longer dictated by them, if they spend the entire time catching up, then this magical season is going to end in a very unmagical way.
Yeah, well, now you got Steph back into your starting rotation again.
Yep.
So you just got to figure they're going to be back in the groove. They're also, because I think they know too, this is Western Conference Finals. Now we're playing OKC. Yep. That they're going to be more focused, and there's going to be, I mean, what Kerr complained again about in both the game four and five was a lack of urgency.
Sure.
And a lack of focus, the turnovers and stuff. So they're going to have a sense of urgency now.
And they got four games to kind of get everything together, right? I mean, to work on their offense, make sure that they're all cohesive. So, I mean, I think we'll see it, but we better. Speaking of Steph's return, that game four, I think, is in my, like, top five TV watching experiences. Not, like, TV sport watching experiences or even just sports experiences. Of all the things I've ever watched on television throughout my entire life, which is a lot, Scott. I watch way too much TV. That was top five. What a hell of a game.
It was the type of thing where you couldn't help but the next day go into work or, like, try to hope somebody on the bus talked to you or, you know, you were going to find somebody who also watched that game the night before and just say, what a great, amazing game that was.
You know what it was, at least for me. So look at a TV show, look at a movie. What a good one of those always has is adversity. There's a bad guy, there's downside, there's drama, moments when our main characters are not getting what they want. And then in the end, when they somehow overcome that drama and they reach the goal we always wanted them to have, it's so much more satisfying. It makes you feel fantastic. The Warriors have had a lot of success this year, more success than any team ever had in the regular season. What they didn't have a lot of was drama. You know, they ran away with a lot of those games. And to have them go through that hardship, to watch them have to fight through what seemed to be remarkably poor officiating and a really tough Portland crowd, you know, made it that much more sweet. And then add in the fairy tale thing of Steph not only coming back, but then going into the phone booth for overtime and coming back and reminding the world that, yep, Damian Lillard's pretty good, but he's not the back-to-back unanimous MVP. You know, like, it was so sweet.
I mean, what do you think it would have been sweeter if Steph had just made the game winner at the end of regulation?
No, I do not.
Because I thought that would have been a pretty great story, too. You come back, yes. And because he was already hitting his flow at the end of the fourth. He hit some big threes,
yep.
And then he hits the game winner. And, you know, what a great story to come back on your first game back.
If we only know this because the sliding door scenario allowed us to see the overtime win, right?
Was that a Jennifer Aniston?
I don't think it was Jennifer Aniston, but the concept is that.
I think that was a movie that she was in.
Oh, it was definitely a movie. I'm not, it could have, maybe it was Jennifer Aniston. Either way, now that, you don't mind if I continue my point, right? We don't have to, do you want to talk about the movie?
This guy just claims that he saw every watch a ton of TV. But
I do.
Sliding Doors.
I didn't say, no, I've seen the movie too. I just haven't memorized its cast. Either way, in this in particular Sliding Door moment, if he had hit that shot at the end of regulation, we never got to see what could have happened in overtime, then I would have been talking about how it was the greatest ending ever and I couldn't have been happier. But we actually got to see the one thing that was better than that. Steph hits that shot at the end of regulation. You know what we don't get? Paul Allen's stunned face.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah. You know, like we don't, because, you know, that could go either way and he got lucky. There was nothing lucky about 17 points. Nothing. That was dominant, not lucky.
Like you said, it was gratifying. Like, it was just like, and when he says, I'm here, I'm back.
Oh.
Just like, ugh.
Oh, no, everything. And, you know, let me, as long as we're going overly rosy, let me give you something I've been thinking about, see if you agree. I can see a scenario where this Steph injury actually helps the Warriors. Stick with me. Here's what I mean. 2012, Steph gets hurt, right? And he has to miss, what, the back 28 games of the season. And then the next year, he signs an extension at much less money than he otherwise would have. And that ended up really helping the Warriors. Why they got Iguodala, why they kept Draymond, I mean, why they had the money to put together the team they have this year. somewhat similarly rosy, maybe, if Steph comes back as Steph. Obviously, if he's anything less than the MVP going forward, then it's a huge loss. Steph comes back as Steph. His absence allowed Draymond to grow and realize he can be the man in a playoff series, allowed Klay to realize he could be the center of an offense, allowed smaller players like Ian Clark to get the kind of experience that you need going forward. I can see a world where this actually helps them.
I see that view, but to me, I think the bigger thing I worry about is just the type of minutes it put on guys like Livingston and Iguodala. And I think you're seeing it take its toll on Livingston, who just hasn't quite seemed the same the last game, four and five.
4 games now, though, right? I mean, they do have all this, or 4 days rest now, where they get to get their legs back under them.
And hopefully that helps. But it just worries me to be putting extra minutes and pressure on these guys. And gosh, I mean, Livingston getting ejected, and I guess, yeah, he didn't play a full game in game four.
This may be shocking to hear, but I actually expected you not to agree with me, so I had to seek out somebody who would. Steve Kerr, this is a quote right after the Houston series. Going into the next series, which will be more difficult, it's good to have a few games under our belts without Steph, so we get a feel for it. It's good for our guys' confidence. Now, I don't think he wanted to lose him to a knee injury immediately thereafter, but, you know, it was... He seems to see some of the things I was saying.
Another thing that was great about game four was leading up to the game, how Steph started the day as doubtful.
Yeah.
Then it became questionable.
Yeah.
Then it became he's going to play but come off the bench, minute restrictions. And then it just Livingston gets ejected.
Yeah,
and it's just like, okay, that's all off the table. This guy's playing.
You see Livingston came out and said he tried to get the first technical to get people fired up, and then he got kicked out. He was surprised by that. And then actually gave a really supposedly rousing speech at halftime that got everybody going. My question is, do you think, like, this whole concept of get a technical to fire up your team, do you understand that?
I thought he actually was getting ejected on purpose. I was surprised to get him fired up.
Take me through that. Why? Why do I get fired up? If it's technical ejection, what is it? If you're my teammate, you get a tech from the ref, why am I more angry now?
I just know personally from when I play, things start out to me like, you know, I try to become intense, but as soon as somebody calls it out of bounds and I thought it was inbounds, or calls a foul that I don't think it was a foul, that just gets me so charged up.
Yeah.
And so to see a player get so wrongly treated by a ref in the way that Livingston got treated by,
sure,
Scott Foster and getting ejected, I could see that would just drive me insane and say, okay, I need to get really focused. It's just like when you lose, like when the Warriors lost Steph, I think people got ultra focused.
Yeah.
In a way that they're not when Steph is there.
And it shakes up the norm, right? Like the danger of when you're getting your ass kicked on the road is that you kind of get sucked in to this one-way train. The crowd's going crazy around you. Next thing you know, you look up, you're down 25 or something. Whereas if you have something that changes it, even if it's a bad thing, even if it means free throws, a sudden explosion of emotion might shake up what's happening. And it sounds like that's what Livingston was going for. You mentioned Scott Foster. I'll keep it personal. Watching the only downside of that was the officiating. I was losing my mind. It absolutely felt like Scott Foster had some kind of betting interest in the game. Let me ask you straight out, do you think there's any chance? I mean, we joke about conspiracy theories in the NBA basically because of Tim Donaghy. Do you think that either Foster in that game specifically or generally, do refs actually have some interest in the outcome of a game?
Well, the thing about Foster that's interesting about that in the context of this question is he has very close ties to Scott Foster. I'm sorry, to Tim Donaghy.
Right.
So,
and
I mean,
to Scott Foster.
Maybe. Yeah, yeah, I hope so. So, I mean, back in 2006 to 2007, when this whole Donaghy scandal went down, Scott Foster made something like, or they had like 136 phone calls between the two of them, like moments after Donaghy had just called his bookie. So, I mean, that raises, I think, a lot of questions. And like Scott Foster named Tim Donaghy as his kid's godfather.
David Stern is such a savage that like that isn't common knowledge. You know what I mean? Like that he was able to cut the head off the snake so fast when they were doing that Tim Donaghy investigation that Foster is even still allowed in the league, even though he had that kind of connection with Donaghy. But what about the idea in that game? Do you think he actually had some interest? Was he trying to push that towards the Blazers?
I actually don't think he was trying to push it towards the Blazers or the Warriors. I really believe that Scott Foster is just an incompetent referee who's an egomaniac.
Yeah.
And every single time you see him reffing a game, it becomes a Scott Foster show. Yeah. There's no other official in the league that I usually end up kind of finding out about throughout the broadcast, but inevitably any game that Scott Foster refs, somehow at some point the announcers are going to name Scott Foster, and you find out he was reffing the game.
Absolutely. Let's see. I'm stealing this from a Twitter follower, and forgive me, I forget who said it, but they said that he went full Lieutenant Drebin from Naked Gun. I don't know if you remember the reference, but in Naked Gun,
was he in Sliding Doors?
That was Jennifer Aniston. Okay. No, but in this in particular one, a cop pretends to be an umpire, calls a strike in a baseball game, finds out that the crowd goes crazy, and then starts calling strikes left and right, getting more and more fired up because he likes to play to the crowd. I don't think Foster was playing to the crowd, but I do think he just likes to be the center of attention. And so Livingston said something, for example, instead of kind of measuring it, is that tech worthy? It's more like, oh, you don't do that to Scott Foster. And then we see the kind of ridiculous eruption that he gave. That kind of egotistic behavior does not belong in an NBA referee jersey. You can't. You know, you should be invisible, not the opposite, which was really annoying. Let me play the clip that you pulled out, putting the two together. Randomly enough, Tim Donaghy was on a podcast, which I can't believe at all. I didn't know he was just out there. Isn't he in prison or something? Like, is he just loose?
Not just a podcast, but a podcast the morning of Game 4, yeah. Warriors Blazers.
Okay, just so reason. I am upset by that for multiple reasons, probably not the least of which is that you haven't brought him on our show, which is a little upsetting.
I did not know he was making the podcast interview circuit.
But here is Tim Donaghy talking about Scott Foster right before Game 4, right?
Yeah, right before Game 4.
I saw the officials' assignments for tonight's Blazers-Warriors game. I saw Scott Foster and Ed Malloy and Tom Washington, and I thought, I wonder what Donaghy thinks about that. What do you think of that crew?
You know, it's a good crew. It's two guys that are going to be kind of just laid back in Washington, and Malloy calling what's probably directly in their primary. And you have Foster, who tends to get a little wild with the whistle and blow all over the floor. And I think he's going to do that like he does it all the time in regard to making sure that the road team gets a fair shake.
You know, you kind of gave that scouting report on Malloy and Washington kind of being laid back as officials and Foster getting a little whistle happy. How does that dynamic play out in a game when you know you're on the court and maybe you're one of the laid-back guys and you see Foster going sideways a little? Do those guys just let it happen, or do they do something and intervene?
No, they let it happen. He's the crew chief. So basically, he's the guy that the NBA put in charge of the game, and he's going to manage everything. And if you see a team that has 14 fouls and a team that doesn't have any, you're going to see a guy like Scott Foster go up the floor and grab a hand check or an impede, a real cheap foul, just to get that personal foul up on the board. So he tries to even it out a little bit. And so go in the locker room at halftime and ask for a stat sheet and look at the free throws. And if the three free throws are off a little bit, he's going to come out in the third quarter and make sure that team that doesn't have as many free throws, you know, gets a couple cheap ones to try and even it out to make sure everybody feels that they got a fair shake.
What do you feel about the concept of the thing that really caught my attention on that is this idea that Scott Foster would try to even things out, that if he notices there's four fouls one way, he's going to call it on the other team. As an NBA fan, do you want to see that? Do you like that someone is paying attention to the objective stats and, oh, this must not be fair, so I'm going the other way? Or would you prefer them just call it straight the whole way?
On the foul count thing, I actually agree with Scott Foster. I would like to see it be more even, because just like you said on last week's podcast, there's a foul on pretty much every NBA play. Sure. So the idea of some team having, and it happened actually in Game 5, in the fourth quarter, I believe, it was at one point was like 4-1. Fouls to the Blazers had one foul to the Warriors 4. But I would also like to see just officials making the right call in the moment, and if they blow it, just move on to the next one and call the next one right.
I mean, this almost seems like, you know, a double negative trying to make a positive, right? Like, what if they've made a bunch of mistakes? They blew three calls, so now it is 4-1, just the way he's saying. Does that mean they need to blow the next three to try to get it closer? You know, I mean, like, if you screwed those things over, human error is going to happen. Just call the game. You know, don't look at what the counts are. Don't look at like what other people are thinking or what they might think. Call the game. You know, that's what the hell you're doing. The coach doesn't look at the shooting stats and see, ooh, Durant, Westbrook. Presumably, if Durant's super hot and taking way more shots than Westbrook, he doesn't go and force the ball to Westbrook to make sure that the things are even, right? Just let the game play. Do, you know, play your roles. Don't try to overstep that.
It's like when
that
you
was a terrible analogy for me.
I was just
forcing it down your throat. I appreciate you not. It looked like you were going to support me, and I appreciate that.
I had glazed eyes.
Yeah, it was awful. It was a terrible analogy.
But I'll make my own analogy, which is, it's like when you try to tell a lie and then you just keep telling a lie and then another lie to try to cover up that lie. It's a losing battle. Eventually, like, you may as well just come out after that first lie, just say, look, I wasn't telling the truth.
Whose analogy do you think is worse? I really appreciate you doing that, because you bailed me out with your own terrible, terrible analogy. Well, either way, great series, unbelievable game four. We've got a lot ahead of us. The Warriors played well. What do you think? B? What do you give them?
I give them a B+ because they didn't have Steph for so much of the series.
Right. And they show the kind of heart, and it shows the kind of arrogant, pompous zone I've entered as a fan for them to be scooting into the Western Conference Finals, and I'm, you know, pissy that they didn't play A+ ball, which actually leads to this next point. Enjoy this. And I'm speaking to Warrior fans out there. I know that you are, Scott. But we're never going to see this again. Not this. You know, you're not going to see 73 wins. You're not going to see a shot at back-to-back championships with back-to-back MVPs. You're not going to see it in a context where everything feels new and unbelievable, because this team hasn't been there. You know, take it from someone who watched this team be awful. We are not very far away from this becoming history, from it just being done. And we'll be talking about it, right? Like, oh, do you remember that team? How great it was. At best, we have 8 games left with these guys. Enjoy it. Soak it up. Invite people over. Get hammered. Have parties. This isn't happening again. So make sure you treat it that way.
So are you saying right now they don't go back to back to back?
I'm saying that even if they went back to back to back, that would be remarkably difficult, and I would love it. But even if they do that, the chances of Steph being your third MVP, you know, is almost zero. And the chance of them having 73 wins again is going to be a really difficult thing to put together.
But that's not to say it wouldn't be more satisfying next year for them to, like, enter the playoffs as a third seed and then put together this incredible run to the finals and winning it.
God, how many times are you going to flip-flop on this? You told me that if they don't win the championship at 173, the season would be a success. Now you seem to be telling me regular season means nothing and it's only about postseason success.
If the question is, do I think that 73 wins is going to be more enjoyable than winning a championship this year?
I think what we are seeing, let me see, you're doing a better job. Them winning a championship, especially if they do it this year, is one component of the perfect storm we find ourselves in the middle of. Recognize that it's a perfect storm. You know, that I don't think we're going to see this many things come together at the same time, and we're almost through it. We're almost on the other side of it. So while we're here, don't wait till you're talking to somebody at a bar about how you used to be able to watch the 2016 Warriors. Enjoy the hell out of it right now.
Yeah, because it's going to be the type of thing that you talk to everyone about down the road. Like, I watched every single game this season, you know, and I'm really happy to say that.
I went to a game when the Warriors almost beat the 96 Bulls way the hell back when. And if I can fit that into a bar conversation, I will pompously force it in, because it makes me feel important. It's a social sports status symbol, right? We have that with our team. Enjoy it. Enjoy it. Slightly less upbeat question, but it's a topic I've been meaning to raise, and we didn't get a chance because we've had guests. Luke Walton is leaving the Warriors. He's on his way to Los Angeles. Good for him. I'm sure it's the right move. He's got a history there, and they're going to pay him a lot of money. Here's my question. You're Steve Kerr. Now you know Luke Walton's leaving. You go into the locker room, and you're getting ready to drop knowledge on your players and presumably something that may help Walton beat you in the future as an opposing coach. Do you ask Walton to leave that locker room?
Come on, dude, he's still on the team. I'm not even sure I should answer this, because of course you're still trying to win a championship and do the best job that you can do this year with your team. He's not some like traitor.
You don't look at him differently at all. Nothing. I'm okay. The concept, I was going to say, look, I would let Luke Walton talk first, you know, and then ask him to put on a Laker jersey and wait outside as I drop the real advice. Obviously that's ridiculous. No, he's a part of it. But I would also be lying if I'm the head coach. I mean, Luke Walton is learning every single day. That knowledge is going to be used against me. Am I at least thinking twice? Am I aware that he's in there listening? Yes, I would be. It would bother me a little bit.
You've already given him everything that you can give him, and it's only going to kind of benefit your legacy to see him go on and do well at the Lakers.
Only at your downside.
No,
and
no,
what,
no.
He gets to see how, before, he had no idea how to deal with a situation without your star player, right? Every single game presents a new challenge that he is learning from. I mean, look, Steve Kerr is a much better person than I am. It sounds like you are too. I'm sure he's handling it the exact same way, but I do think there's got to be something that rattles around in Kerr's brain when he's, if in fact he is dropping knowledge that he has not yet dropped to Walton. I would not be real eager to let Walton know any of that.
Why would you create strife on your team currently in the pursuit of a championship?
No, that's why I'm okay. I told you that the go wait outside thing is a joke. But I just mean you wouldn't have any reservations in your mind. He's never going to speak them. He can't say anything. But I'd be weirded out. It's an opposing coach in your huddle.
Look, there's nothing that you can say that's going to be some magic bullet that's going to allow Luke Walton to turn around this Lakers team, okay? They're terrible. Whatever advice he can give is not going to do it. If the situation was different and there was, you know, $1 million locked in some safe and Steve Kerr could have that $1 million or he could tell Luke Walton the code, that's a totally different story, because then you know that information is going to absolutely lead to a result that you don't want.
Let's say Steve Kerr has favorite inbound plays for specific situations, right? And that he just likes to use them. And he always has, and he always will. And we now fast forward 5 years down the line. The Lakers have been able to pull together a team. Warriors are still okay. They're both still coaching. At the end of the game, Steve Kerr would like to call a play. He knows that Walton knows the exact play that he'd like to call, right? Because he was in there and he knew it's come. That's a disadvantage. There's no way he doesn't think about that.
If you're Steve Kerr, you're using all this right now to Jedi mind trick him and just, and
okay,
basically.
There's the bitterness. Okay, I knew if we dug deep enough, we'd be able to get into some takes that were supporting me.
Or, I mean, in the situation you just described, he knows, Luke Walton knows that he likes to use this play.
Right.
So he's going to use a different one and knowing, you know, use the play that Luke thought as a decoy.
Also, in my scenario, apparently Steve Kerr does not grow at all in 5 years and is unable to come up with any new plays. So it may not be that realistic. Maybe I'm the only one who's super bitter, which brings me to a completely unrelated as far as basketball is concerned, but very related as far as bitterness and neurosis is concerned. Social justice topic, here it is. I got an email from a friend fairly recently, and it was an invite to a bachelor party, and there's like 50 people on the email, and it wasn't one of those BCC situations, right? I could actually look at the full list of people who had been emailed this invite. And my first move, and this has been true for me for 3 or 4 years, my first move was to open up the list, see who he had emailed it to, and then find out where I was in that social hierarchy. Right.
So that's always the move, right?
Okay, that's what I'm asking. Okay, so, and just to make sure, and I'm so happy to hear you're as bitter as I am, and I want to explore that, but the first thing I'll do is, okay, is it alphabetical? Because then that makes sense. It has nothing to do with me, right? But if it's not alphabetical, then it came up with like, well, where did you think of me in your friend group? You do that? You'll check things out and see where you landed on the email list?
I check it out. I'm also very conscious when I put together my own group emails.
What do you do? Do you go alphabetical?
I usually go to the first person that pops into my mind, and then I rattle off kind of the friend group that's involved with that person, and then I move on to the next friend group.
Doesn't that set up hierarchies within the friend groups, though? Like, for example, you send that email to me, my friend group's like 5 or 6 people down. I'm not taking that well.
It's a tough situation. I mean, somebody's got to be last, and you just got to hope that the person's not one of these sensitive people like Bram.
Do you think, and like Bram and Scott, I feel like you just admitted that you do the same thing.
I said I look. I don't say I get, what did you describe as some neurosis?
My neurosis was just looking. I think we have the same one in this in particular instance. If you're out there listening, I'd love to hear. I've brought this up to a few friends. I think I'm in the deep minority. Not many people do this unfortunate and kind of desperate move. If you do, I really, really want to hear about it, which is a random but good place to end. Huge fun, you guys. True every week, certainly true this week. Please remember, you want to reach out to us, tell me how crazy I am, give us a take to bring up, questions, anything. You can hit us at warriorshuddle@gmail.com. Our Twitter account is @warriorshuddle. Our website is warriorsworld.net. We are on a ton of podcasting services, including Google Play, Scotty, and iTunes. A lot of you have given us phenomenal reviews. In fact, we're going to cover some of those next week. We appreciate it. If you wouldn't mind, if you haven't given us a review yet, hop out there, give us 5 stars. Go Warriors, and hopefully we'll see you next week. Just get ready for work, 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 work. For me, I be work, 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 work. You see me do me da, 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 da. Just love me by that work, 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 work. Da, 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 da. When you walk out, da, 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 da. Before the table, turn, 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 turn.
Good, good.